You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. Next up, we have the BBC News and then a public affair.
BBC World Service.
Hello, I'm Roisin Hasty with the BBC News. The former head of World Central Kitchen has told the BBC that he finds it very, very hard to believe that Israeli forces didn't know about the presence of its staff when launching the strike that killed seven aid workers. Nate Mook said he believed that more aid agencies would pull out.
Famine was already declared or nearly declared in northern Gaza by the United Nations. The United Nations, the World Food Program, has been unable to access these areas. This is a tragedy, you know, not just for the aid community, not just for the families of those we've lost, but, you know, this is a tragedy for the people of Gaza and really for the world.
The White House National Security spokesperson has said the U.S. doesn't expect the Israeli strike that killed seven aid workers in Gaza to affect talks on a ceasefire and the release of hostages. Sebastian Usher reports.
Hopes for a truce in Gaza have faded in recent weeks after a flurry of activity ahead of Ramadan. The latest comments emerging over the status of negotiations suggest but little progress has been made. The Prime Minister of Qatar, which has been playing a key role in mediation, says the obstacles are the same as back in February. Mohammed bin Abdurrahman Al Thani did say that the Hamas demand for displaced Palestinians to be able to return to all parts of Gaza had become a major bone of contention. The political leader of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, has also reiterated that his movement is sticking to all its conditions for a truce. It seems that for now at least, the gap between the positions of Hamas and the Israeli government remains too wide to reach a deal.
The Speaker of Parliament in South Africa, Nosifiwe Mapisa Nkakula, has resigned in the continuing fallout from the raid on her home last month by anti-corruption police. Ms. Mapisa Nkakula is accused of soliciting bribes in return for awarding contracts during her time as defence minister. She has denied the charges. Rescuers in Taiwan are attempting to reach dozens of people trapped after a magnitude 7.4 earthquake. At least nine people have been killed. Rupert Wingfield Hayes reports from Taiwan.
This evening, in the city of Hualien, teams of rescuers are still searching for people trapped in collapsed buildings. Several large buildings in the city now lean over at absurd angles, as if ready to topple at any moment. Eastern Taiwan is a mountainous and rugged landscape, and that brought another terrifying threat. Along the coast, the quake unleashed massive rockfalls, whole mountainsides seemingly slipping into the valley below. Roads are now strewn with massive boulders, bridges severed, and tunnels blocked. One famously perilous stretch of road is now cut off at both ends, with several tour buses stranded inside a tunnel.
World News from the BBC.
Hi, I'm Mel from The Mel and Floyd Show. Come on down and join Floyd and me Friday, April 5th from 1 to 2 for our annual Wisconsin Film Festival live show. This year we'll be broadcasting from the Bartell Theater, 116 East Mifflin Street. We'll be interviewing our usual assortment of interesting people from the fest, including directors, actors, writers, people from the craft services table, and if we have some time to fill, maybe some interesting looking passersby. We'll cover raging film controversies such as popcorn, butter or no butter, seating, center or aisle, and how to properly shush a loud patron. Heady stuff? It certainly is. Yes, it's going to be quite the wild ride indeed. So let's all go to the lobby. Come join the fun with Mel and Floyd at the Bartell Theater Friday, April 5th from 1 to 2 for our annual Wisconsin Film Festival remote broadcast.
To our physical archives, courtesy of the archiving team here at WORT, and bringing you a speech given by Howard Zinn in Janesville in 1988. Howard Zinn was a historian, playwright, and activist, and what he has to say is important today as much as it was in 1988. Enjoy.
Thank you. I think my subject tonight is democracy, dissent, and disobedience. And I think right now, in the midst of the, you know, the presidential debate, if that's what it is, in the midst of the campaign, if that's what it is, in the midst of all of the attention paid, this is a good time, I think, to take stock of the problem of dissent in American society, because there doesn't seem to be very much dissent in the election campaign that's going on. The election campaign seems to represent a kind of consensus arrived at by two candidates who are very, very carefully and cautiously playing towards center field, you know, and leaving everything else untouched because it's dangerous. I talk about democracy, that's in my title, because I believe that there is a prevailing view of democracy, prevailing in the sense that we grow up with it in America. We learn it in school, and it is part of the culture. It is part of the American ideology, if that is using the word ideology to describe a sort of a coherent set of ideas which dominate a society and which are the acceptable ideas of the society. There's an acceptable view about democracy for anybody growing up in the United States. An acceptable view is that democracy consists of representative government. That is, we learn about democracy in, I don't know when it starts, in junior high school, certainly in high school and college, and we learned that it consists of people electing their representatives. It starts with the Constitution, which neatly set up a democratic state, and it has lasted. Everybody tells us, you know, the Constitution has lasted 200 years, and we have this steadfast set of democratic institutions. We have a balance of powers. We have checks and balances. We have federal state separation. We have all of these elements that make for a democratic government. Elements which, in fact, we look for abroad when we try to decide whether a country abroad is democratic or not. Right. The first question is asked: have they had an election? We usually call it a free election, whether it's a free election or not. There's hardly any election which is free anywhere, including the United States, I might add, although there are certainly more unfree elections than the United States. But I think it's not easy to find places where there are truly free elections, because elections tend to be dominated and distorted by money, by power, by the class and race divisions of a society. But we grow up thinking that democracy consists of having this kind of structure, having a legislature, having an executive, having a Supreme Court, having laws passed, and that the supreme act of citizenship in a democracy is for a person to go to the polls once in 4 years. And think of that. This is the supreme act of citizenship. That really is all you have to do. Once in 4 years, you go to the polls. You walk into that little booth and pull the chain, or pull a lever, or do whatever you have to do in that little booth, and you fulfill your obligation to democracy. Along with this is the idea that it's a system that allows for change. It's part of the ideology and part of the consensus about democracy, part of this dominant view of democracy, this prevailing view that, we understand that this democracy is not perfect. We understand that there are problems. There may be race problems. There may be economic problems. There may be all sorts of problems. No, we're not perfect. But this system has a way of taking care of these problems. The system of checks and balances and representative government and voting and so on, all of that will ensure that if there's a problem, the problem will be taken care of. And there are channels to go through. And if you go through those channels, then the problem will be solved. If you have a severe problem, well, you will elect a leader who will take care of this. That's what voting is for. You will elect a savior from time to time in American history, right? We've had severe problems. And when we've had those severe problems, we have found saviors to take care of those problems. We had a little problem very early on with England. That is, they wanted us, and we didn't want them. That was the problem. But the founding fathers took care of everything for us. We had a problem with slavery, a little problem. You know, we all have our little faults, and slavery was just, you know, one of those little blemishes on American democracy, which lasted for 200 years, a long blemish. But Lincoln took care of it. The great emancipator solved the problem of slavery. We had a problem of a depression, of an economic crisis. Roosevelt came along at just the right time, and the New Deal put us back on the same road that we're now traveling, the road of, well, what is it? Prosperity, good times, things everywhere for people to have, and so on. So that, I believe, is a prevailing view of what democracy consists of. And yes, the Constitution is somehow at the center of it. So that when we had the bicentennial, remember we had a bicentennial? Bicentennial Commission was headed by Warren Burger. Remember him? He was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court before Rehnquist. And Burger was the proper person to head the bicentennial. Also, I think on his commission was Strom Thurmond, a person who, old-time senator from South Carolina, perfect person to celebrate the bicentennial of the Constitution, having been a person who had violated it for so much of his life. But the bicentennial was a way of reminding us, as we were reminded again and again. President Reagan made a number of speeches reminding us of how the Constitution was this hard rock of democracy, which had served us for so long and so well, and that we could depend on it. And somehow the idea conveyed by all of this was that with this rock of a constitution, there really isn't too much for us to do. It's there, right? We can depend on it. It will take care of us. Oh, I remember Burger's constitutional, his bicentennial commission sold constitution bowls. Did you know that? You missed out on that. It was a big ad. It was a full-page ad. I think it was in Parade magazine, which is a scholarly journal. That some of you may read from time to time. And it was a full-page ad for the Constitution Bowl. When I saw this ad, this picture, this really exquisite bowl, I was transfixed when I looked at it. And when I saw that, I thought, oh, somebody is cashing in on the bicentennial. by selling bowls. Then I looked down at the small print and I saw it was the official bicentennial commission that was selling these bowls. And then when I thought about it, I wasn't supposed to think about it, I was supposed to just buy it. But when I thought about it, I thought, that was really perfect. That was it. That told the story that the Constitution was a beautiful bowl, which was empty. This may strike some of you as an unpatriotic remark, but I'm serious about that. I'm serious about that unpatriotic remark. That is, it's empty in the sense that it's a very elegant set of words constituting this concave structure which needs to be filled with something before it has any meaning. And the Constitution by itself, if it's not filled with the action of citizens, with the doings of people, is meaningless. There's a lot of history to corroborate that statement. I want to just take a look at some of the things in history which cast a good deal of doubt on this prevailing notion which I described, that democracy is fulfilled by a set of institutions which have developed over time, starting with the Constitution, with a number of amendments and so on. The prevailing view that democracy is fulfilled that way and that the structure is self-correcting. That is, that if problems arise, that structure is adequate, the Constitution is adequate, system of voting and representation are adequate, the Supreme Court is adequate, Congress is adequate, the President is adequate. They are adequate to take care of the problems that we face. And I'm suggesting that whenever we have had really serious critical problems in this country, this structure, this Constitution, has not been able to solve those problems. And anybody who rested their hope simply on the Constitution was resting their hope, on an empty vessel. Probably the most clear-cut illustration of this is with the problem of race in the United States. There's probably no group of people in the United States, I would guess, who better understand the emptiness of constitutional provisions and the inadequacy of the traditional legislative structure than of black people in this country. They were enslaved before we had a constitution, before we had a government, but before even there were any laws about slavery. That slavery was a reality before there were laws which legalized slavery. As blacks could understand that it doesn't seem to be laws that determine reality, but reality that determines laws. And that's a very important thing to know, because if you don't know that, you will be greatly deceived. You will think that when a law is passed, wow, that's it. I remember once, quite long ago, seeing a headline, "Caste System Abolished in India." And then meeting somebody from India, "Ah, I see your caste system has been abolished." Yeah, officially. The reality to India, which didn't move as quickly as writers of headlines. But the black people in this country had the experience of going through the kind of struggles that led to so-called emancipation. which I think led them to understand that emancipation did not simply come as a result of the beneficence of Abraham Lincoln. And Lincoln, and to those of you who have studied a little of the history of that period, you probably know very well what I'm talking about, and that Lincoln was a very reluctant emancipator. Lincoln had to be pushed into emancipation by a set of events, one of those events being a huge amount of agitation in the country, the building of a great movement, the building of the abolitionist movement from a very tiny movement of the 1830s to a nationwide movement of the 1850s and the early 1860s. A movement which consisted of an enormous number of acts of civil disobedience, of breaking the law, of violating the Fugitive Slave Act, of doing all the kinds of things that outside the structure of government. The structure of government was not only inadequate, the structure of government legalized slavery. The Constitution legalized slavery. William Lloyd Garrison, the Boston abolitionist, at a meeting of the New England Anti-Slavery Society in 1835, held up a copy of the Constitution and set a match to it, because the Constitution, he said, represented slavery, which it did in its various provisions. Lincoln understood this. Lincoln was a lawyer, and Lincoln was not going to go outside the law, and Lincoln was not going to tamper with slavery, and didn't tamper with slavery until he was pressured and forced and pushed to do it by military circumstances in the war and by the growth of a huge movement in the country in which people again and again went outside the structure. Outside the structure to the extent of, well, when people in various places in the North were convicted of violating the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. It was a crime to not to turn a slave over to a master who wanted to get the slave back. And there were groups of people in the North, black and white, who went into courtrooms and into police stations and rescued slaves. And then they were brought up on trial. And then, in a number of cases, the juries refused to find them guilty.
That is Howard Zinn coming from 1988 in Janesville, brought to you by the WORT Archiving Project.
Of course, with the Civil War and with the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments, which then finally legalized emancipation, Emancipation Proclamation itself was a rather weak kind of statement. It had moral fervor, but it didn't have much practical effect. But the 13th Amendment legalized the abolition of slavery, and then the 14th Amendment presumably created equality and presumably did away with racial discrimination. And wrote it into the Constitution. The 15th Amendment underlined it by making it specific with regard to the right to vote. And so now you have the Constitution, no longer a slave document, but an egalitarian document. Now the Constitution, for the first time, declared to the states that they could not enslave people and they could not discriminate against people on the basis of race and could not prevent them from voting on the basis of race. So there it was in the Constitution. And of course, what happened is that, well, the Constitution was obeyed for a few years, so long as blacks were organized in the South and federal troops were in the South, and so long as it was convenient for black politicians to look for the black vote, and so long as it was seen that you could even win a presidential election, as Grant did, by getting blacks to vote and keeping whites away from the polling booths, so long as practical, to make an alliance with blacks, the 14th and 15th Amendments meant something. But as soon as it became impractical, as soon as it was seen that there was no point making an alliance with blacks, what do they have? They may have the vote. They don't have any money. They don't have any land. You don't want to give them money. You don't want to give them land. You don't want to make them a force. There are real people in the South, white people, who have money, who have prestige. They're the ones you have to make an alliance with. And once you recognize that reality, the 13th, 14th Amendment, 15th Amendments become dead. Yes, even the 13th Amendment, which does away with slavery, doesn't mean very much because blacks are now held in a kind of peonage, kind of semi-slavery. They're not officially slaves, but they could just as well be because they're tied to the land, to the plantation, to this owner, to this spot. They have no money. They have no resources. They can't do this. They can't do that. And the 14th and 15th Amendments are dead, and racial segregation becomes implanted in the country. And this is not just the doing of the southern states. This is the doing of the federal government. The federal government, the Supreme Court, removes all the teeth from the 14th Amendment. The Supreme Court rules again and again that the 14th Amendment doesn't have any real relationship to what is going on in the South, that the 14th Amendment does not mean that you can't segregate blacks, that the 14th Amendment does not mean that you can't keep blacks out of hotels and restaurants and so on. And the 15th Amendment, saying you can't discriminate against people on the ground, well, that doesn't mean anything either if you don't mention the word race in the way you keep people from the polls. You can just give them a... Don't mention race. Just give them a literacy test, which is administered by the county registrar. And the county registrar in Mississippi has the job of testing the literacy of black people who want to register to vote in Mississippi by asking them to interpret, to read and interpret one of the 285 clauses of the Mississippi Constitution, which the registrar will select for them to interpret. And he will select this clause for white people who want to register, and this clause for black people who want to register. This clause for white people will say, there shall be freedom of speech in Mississippi. You can interpret that, you white people. Black people, you will interpret this clause, which has to do with intestate wills and landed property and something that's about a page long and which a PhD in business administration would have difficulty understanding. But that way you don't have to mention race, you can keep blacks from voting, and the Supreme Court will be perfectly happy. The blacks, this is what blacks were aware of. The 14th, 15th, 13th, dead for 100 years, the Constitution of the United States, unenforced by Congress, unenforced by the President of the United States, who had the power, by the way, if you look at an obscure provision of the 14th Amendment, the President of the United States had the power to decrease the representation of southern states if they discriminated against people, if they kept people away from the polls on the grounds of race. No president, liberal, conservative, Roosevelt, Hoover, Kennedy, no president ever invoked that. So it wasn't just the South and the racists of the South. It was the North. It was the federal government. It was the Constitution. It was the Supreme Court. It was the president. It was the Congress who refused to do anything about racial segregation, about lynchings, about any of the things that were happening to black people in the South. And this generation knows what happened, although they're trying to make us forget it. And that is that the 14th and 15th Amendments did not become reality until black people rose up in the 1950s and 1960s and created this enormous, powerful social movement, a movement in which tens of thousands of people went to jail. 13,000 people went to jail in the first few months of 1963 alone. There were demonstrations in the United States in 1963 in 700 cities. The children's marches in Birmingham. It took all of that to persuade Kennedy, also a reluctant emancipator, also one who came into office as a liberal, promising with a stroke of the pen he would take care of segregated housing, and then couldn't find the pen. But it took that kind of agitation to finally get Kennedy to begin to move, and then after Kennedy was assassinated, to get Lyndon Johnson to realize he'd better do something about the race question. And the Voting Rights Act was passed, and some things began to happen. But there's no clearer evidence than the evidence of the history of black people in this country that the structure of government, the normal processes of government, the channels through which people are asked to go, these are not channels. These are mazes in which people are invited to go in to get lost. But people have learned historically that they have to move outside those channels, that they have to do what democracy demands. Democracy demands not one a vote every 4 years. Democracy demands a constant, never-ending set of actions by people organizing themselves in order to get those rights that are promised in the Declaration of Independence. It's not just a problem limited to black people. It's just that black people are probably the most vivid illustration of it. Working people in this country. Now remember, the Constitution, if you think you can depend on the Constitution, Constitution doesn't say anything about economic rights. Constitution has political rights in various ways, and the right to vote, and the Bill of Rights, and etc. But there's nothing in the Constitution about economic rights. You can try, if you want, to interpret some sections of the Constitution, like the 14th Amendment, the Due Process Clause, and so on, to say, hey, well, maybe this really should be interpreted to mean economic equality, too. For instance, in the early 1970s, in Texas, there was a case brought by people who lived in a poor county in Texas about the quality of their schools. They noticed that in this poor county, the schools were very, very bad. The teacher salaries were very, very low. As a result, they couldn't even get teachers. They didn't have textbooks that were up to date. The schools were dilapidated. The whole educational system was run down. But here in this other county, the county where people were affluent, the schools were good. The salaries of the teachers were high. The educational system was five times as good. And so a man named Rodriguez sued in the city of San Antonio. The case became San Antonio versus Rodriguez. Sued the city of San Antonio saying, 14th Amendment, equality, equal protection of the laws, right to an equal education, perhaps being a fundamental right that Americans should have, and we should have poor kids should have an education equal to the education of rich kids in the public schools. Well, the Supreme Court wouldn't hear of that. Supreme Court, no way. So what has happened in this country? Deprived of a legal basis for bettering economic conditions, the people in this country, the working people in this country, native-born immigrants who found themselves working in factories and mines and mills and working long hours at low wages under the most terrible conditions, what could they do? They had to go outside the law. They had to organize. They had to create a labor movement. This is probably the least reported piece of the history of the United States in the history books. I mean, history books have a little bit. Oh, we have a Pullman strike in 1894, maybe. Ah, yes. Oh, yes, a New Deal, a sit-down strike. Yeah, let's give them a little bit. The actual history of labor struggles in this country is an enormous history. It would take, you know, volumes and volumes and volumes to fill the story of the strikes and boycotts and marches and the things that people did. I mean, how many people went to school and learned about Mother Jones? I'm not talking about the magazine. I never learned about Mother Jones when I went to school. In fact, come to think of it, I just realized when you gave me the introduction, I have a PhD. I studied history right up through the PhD. I mean, how much better can you get than that? I'm a specialist in history. I took all these courses in history. Did I ever, in any one of these history courses right up through the PhD, ever hear the name Mother Jones? Never. But the great struggles that went on in this country for working people simply to get the 8-hour day. Now think how miserable it is to work for 8 hours. I mean, it's terrible to work for 8 hours. And what struggles people had to go through to get the 8-hour day. The government wasn't going to give it to them. The Constitution didn't give it to them. The Supreme Court fought against even child labor laws. The Supreme Court was an obstacle to getting anything done. People had to sacrifice. What do people do when they go out on strike? They sacrifice. Legislation of the New Deal, which is attributed to Roosevelt, and yes, Roosevelt was a liberal, if I may use that term, and Roosevelt was thoughtful. But Roosevelt was not about to pass what was called at one time the Magna Carta of Labor, the Wagner Labor Relations Act, National Labor Relations Act. He wasn't about to pass that until there were strikes all over the country. General strike in San Francisco in 1934, general strike in Minneapolis in 1934, textile strikes in that same year all over. And then, of course, in 1935 and 1936 and 1937, waves of strikes all over the country. The National Labor Relations Act owes its origin not to some kindly people in Congress and the White House, but to those strikes that took place and that finally wrote into law the legitimacy of labor unions.
That is Howard Zinn, the historian, activist, and playwright, coming to you from 1988 in Janesville.
The area of foreign policy is an area which, well, presumably the Constitution has a little bit to say about foreign policy. Gives Congress the power to raise armies, gives President the right to make treaties with the consent of Congress, gives Congress the power to declare war, which was very deliberate. James Madison, who was the big man at the Constitutional Convention and the big note taker and the father of the Constitution, we always have to have fathers for everything. Who was the mother of the Constitution? How could there be? They were all men who wrote the Constitution, right? No founding mothers. But Madison said, it was very, very pointed and very specific, that they wanted to give the right to Congress and not to the president the right to make war, because, as he said, executives are much more prone to go to war. And let me see if I occasionally bring along a note to persuade people that I'm not lying to them. Of course, if I don't find a note, they know I'm lying to them. There we go. It'll just take, I insist on finding, do you ever get into that fanatic mood where, where you'll spend an hour looking for something trivial because you've determined you are going to find it? No matter what. Madison writing to Jefferson in 1798. The Constitution supposes what the history of all governments demonstrates, that the executive is the branch of power most interested in war and most prone to it. It has accordingly, with studied care, vested the question of war in the legislature. This has become a big laugh. And here we are celebrating the bicentennial of the Constitution, right? It's the founding fathers. And here is the father of the founding fathers, James Madison, making it very clear that the president is not supposed to go off on his own and make war, that this is the job of Congress, and that has been studiedly ignored, well, for a long time, ever since World War II, right? Korean War, as we know, was not a war. A police action, right? A lot of policemen died. A lot. The Vietnam War, again, right? And the Congress didn't declare war. Of course, the legislature did not have the guts that Madison thought that the legislature would have. And so it's not simply a matter of blaming the president and exonerating the legislature, because the fact is that Congress, in these various instances, went along like sheep. Right? President Johnson comes before Congress in 1964 in August and says, our Navy has been attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin. Right? I mean, this is a real threat to national security, right? People don't know where the Gulf of Tonkin is. They think it's probably off the coast of San Francisco. The Gulf of Tonkin is on the other side of the world, off the coast of Vietnam. And what were our ships doing there anyway? Oh, well, our ships never do anything. They're just harmless. It was just, you know, routine patrol and so on. And they're fired upon. There's North Vietnamese, those bullies. It's a country without a navy, without an air force, you know. And so ask Congress for a blank check to do whatever he wants to do in that area of the world, and Congress sheepishly complies. Only two senators, right, Gruening and Morris, dissent. But that's, we've seen that repeated in after that, right? The War Powers Act was passed at the end of the Vietnam War, presumably to limit the power of the president to send troops into dangerous situations, and we have seen in the last few years, the War Powers Act is dead. You say, well, this is a law passed by Congress. You try to break a law. Go ahead, break a law. Break a tax law, right? Break a law. You're not supposed to break a law. You're a citizen. The government can break laws all the time, anytime it wants to, because who's going to enforce it? The government? And so they do. So the president breaks the law. The president ignores the War Powers Act, sends troops to Grenada. Well, of course, you had to send troops to Grenada because we were in imminent danger of invasion from Grenada. You know, we know that. And so no time to consult. Sorry. I mean, Grenada is ready to go. And so we've got to take care of Grenada. When the planes were sent over Libya, right? Remember, we bombed. Why did we bomb them? It wasn't even clear that Libya was behind that incident that had taken place in West Germany, which presumably we were punishing Libya for. It still isn't clear, by the way, that Libya was behind that. But, you know, everybody was all head up, right, against Gaddafi. You know, he's the monster of the year. And so anything you do against Gaddafi is all right. Even kill his little daughter, right? Just, what do you, well, sorry, an accident. An accident. You just bombed a neighborhood. And if civilians get killed, well, it's just an accident. But all this, now, you're sending warplanes into an area. What about the War Powers Act? Well, he did notify several Congress. You're supposed to consult, right? There's little differences. You're supposed to consult Congress. There's a difference in consulting and notifying, especially when you notify them when the warplanes are already on their way. which is what happened in the case of the bombing of Tripoli. And of course, the Iran-Contra affair, talk about. I remember thinking of the bicentennial. I somehow have the bicentennial on my mind. I'm a year behind. In which he said, the Constitution is such a wonderful document. It says, there are only certain things that the government officials can do. It can only do those things which are permitted by the Constitution of the United States. He was saying this exactly at the time when the Iran-Contra affair was being told about, and where it was obvious, clear, that the president or his emissaries, and his emissaries, or somehow a whole bunch of people connected with the executive branch, were doing things which the Constitution did not provide for at all. In fact, which the law did not provide for, in fact, which were illegal, to say nothing of immoral. But my point is that to depend on the normal processes of government to take care of foreign policy, voting, and to depend on the Supreme Court, for instance, to declare war unconstitutional, it's absurd. During the Vietnam War, there were several people who, GIs, who brought their cases into court saying they did not want to be sent to Vietnam because the Vietnam War was an unconstitutional war. Supreme Court refused to hear it. You know, you grow up and you learn in junior high school, the job of the Supreme Court is to see if laws are unconstitutional, right? That's the job of the Supreme Court, is to be guardian of the Constitution, of the constitutionality of things. And the Supreme Court is asked to decide the constitutionality of the Vietnam War, and the Supreme Court refuses to hear it. That we have the most democracy in this country for the smallest things. That is, for the most local things, the most immediate things. There's a semblance of democracy with your, you know, local things and your local legislator, and maybe even with your state legislatures, and it gets a little more remote. But you have the most democracy when it comes to things that are visible in domestic affairs. And you have the least democracy when it's matters of life and death. That is, when it's a matter of war or peace. It's a matter of foreign policy. It's a matter of getting into a war. It's a matter of 50,000 people being killed or 150,000 people being maimed in situations like that. Then you might just as well not be a democracy. Then it's assumed by the powers that be that the powers of the president are equivalent and should be equivalent to the powers of any dictator in the world. So that this... the democracy doesn't exist there. And that's why during the Vietnam War, the war could not be stopped by petitions to Congress. The war could not be stopped by the ordinary processes of government. The war could not be stopped by electing another president. In 1964, some of you may recall, the people who voted for Johnson were voting for the dove. Right? As the people who voted for Goldwater were voting for the hawk. They voted for Johnson. And in a very short time, the United States was plunging full scale into the war. So voting doesn't do the trick. Going to the Supreme Court doesn't do the trick. And so we created in this country, little by little, in ways that seemed impossible at first, a great movement against the war. A movement which encompassed millions of people and which changed the thinking of many, many millions more in the country, and finally created an atmosphere in which, along with the fact that the United States simply militarily was not able to win in Vietnam, created an atmosphere in which the government decided, and the advisors to the government decided, we had better withdraw. There's an interesting lesson in that whole episode, because a lesson for citizens who think, what's the point of protesting? What's the point of dissenting? We are weak, the government is strong. We are few, you know. We don't have the resources, they have the resources. What is the point of doing these things? It's not going to get anywhere. What's the point of joining a picket line of five people protesting against the government of the United States. But what was clear during the Vietnam War is that tiny movements become large movements under certain circumstances. That very, very small actions that people take, if enough people take them, create chains of reactions that multiply and that eventually can, under certain circumstances, create a movement which is strong enough to change a government's policy, even in such a matter as stopping a war. And you may remember that Nixon said, I don't pay any attention to these things. You know, these demonstrations don't mean anything to me. It's the constant cry of people in power. Say, look, I'm not going to be affected, right? Like employers. Look, you people out on strike, I don't care. I can hold out, you know. Well, sometimes they can. Depends on how stubborn people are. But it turned out, and we have it now in the evidence of the government itself, the evidence that came out in the Pentagon Papers. Remember those secret papers that were supposed to be kept secret and finally made public by acts of civil disobedience? It turned out that the government all along, while they were saying, we're not paying any attention to these demonstrations, was paying very, very close attention, very, very concerned. If you look through the Pentagon Papers, you'll see again and again references, hey, look what's happening. Draft resistance is growing. We better watch out about public opinion. Public opinion seems to be changing about the war. People are worried about how much bombing we do. The stories of civilian casualties as a result of our bombing are beginning to affect a lot of people. We have to worry about that. And then in the spring of 68, when President Johnson had to make this very critical decision, right after the Tet Offensive of 68, General Westmoreland, who had 535,000 troops in Vietnam. Now, this is a small country. We had 535,000 troops in this little country. And Westmoreland asked Johnson for 200,000 more troops. And Johnson had to make a decision as to whether he's going to continue escalating the war that way. And he gave the job to a little team of advisors, including Clark Clifford, who'd been advisor to a number of presidents, sort of one of the so-called wise men, to tell him what to do. And they looked into the situation. They interrogated a lot of people who had been in Vietnam, and some of them had been in Vietnam themselves and so on. And they gave a report to Johnson in which they said, you'd better not give Westmoreland the 200,000 more troops. One, because the Saigon regime, which we are supporting, has no popular support in Vietnam, and it's just, it's not going to help them. And second, there's going to be too much trouble in this country. Already has been too much trouble, too many draft refusals. Keep in mind that in 1960, just around that time, in Oakland, California, in the draft center where people, young men, were supposed to be inducted for Northern California, 43% of the guys who were supposed to show up did not show up. To this day, there's an enormous amount of ignorance about how many people never registered for the draft, how many people were never prosecuted, how much disaffection among, and how many people deserted, and how many AWOLs there were, how many less than honorable discharges were given to GIs who were unenthusiastic about the war. In fact, how large a movement there was among GIs that was disgusted with the war. And all of this had an effect. And in their report, they pointed this out. We're not going to be able to sustain popular support for this war. And it was at that moment that Johnson decided, I'm not going to give Westmoreland the troops. I'm not going to run for president again. I'm going to go to Paris and start peace negotiations with the North Vietnamese. But my point in all of this is that the action of citizens, which always looks puny and inconsequential, and which is derided by the people in power as not affecting them at all, at certain times in history, not always, but at certain times in history, adds up if it continues and if people don't lose heart, adds up to a very powerful movement which changes something very important. And it was important for us to get out of the Vietnam War, just as important for blacks to be able to vote in the South, and just as important for people in the labor movement to get an eight-hour day and to get workmen's compensation and to be able to have unions and some measure of job security in a very unequal economic system. I guess what I'm getting at, I'm trying to figure out what I'm getting at. What I'm getting at is that there are things for us to do beyond voting. That voting at its best is a, and we're not at our best, voting at its best is an inadequate way of dealing with the very serious problems that we have and which we now have today in the world. Problems of war and peace, problems of, you know, spending $1 trillion in a handful of years, $1 trillion, $300 billion a year, for what? For junk. Really, really, for junk. All based on hobgoblins. I mean, I thought the Soviet Union is real, and, you know, certain real things about the Soviet Union, what it's done to Hungary and what it's done to its own people. I mean, there's a reality there. But beyond that reality, there's a big difference between recognizing what is really bad about the Soviet Union and converting that which is bad into a hysteria in which we are bankrupting ourselves, depleting our resources, militarizing the country, preventing ourselves from solving the problems we need to solve because, well, it's as if we were living on a block where somebody down the street has a criminal record and the family has decided it's going to only eat one meal a day because it's going to put machine guns in all the windows and dynamite around the house because, well, you never know, right, who is going to attack you. Now, really, there's a difference between a kind of rational estimate of the evil that exists in the world and a hysteria which destroys your own life. And here our environment, which is much more serious than the Russians, much more long-term, much more pervasive, much more inexorable. The Russians are a little exorable. As, they change. The Chinese change, the Russians change. Anybody can change. We can change. Everybody can change. But there's something about what's happening to the oceans and the air which is inexorable unless something is done and which requires a huge amount of resources, which requires a lot of citizen action and activity outside of the normal processes of government. So we have a lot of things to do, ranging in civil disobedience, you know, the kind of actions that people, the heroic actions that people take, which get them into court and get them jail sentences that, you know, against nuclear weapons, and those are heroic actions, but you know, only a small number of people are that heroic, and most people can't bring themselves to go that far. But most people can be dissenters, can think for themselves, can act for themselves, can think outside the consensus, can look for sources of information, can spread the word, can dissent in wherever they work or wherever they teach or wherever they study or whatever little spot of earth we occupy. Wherever we are in the society, we can be ourselves and not cringe the way presidential candidates cringe in order to, you know, not to ruffle anybody. We have to ruffle. Only in that way, it seems to me, will we fulfill what democracy requires, what the principles of the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, property, equality for all people, and a world in which we don't care about being number one. Number one. Who cares? Number one. What if we're five? I mean, you know, what, I'm number one in what? Number one in what? Guns? Television sets? You know, who cares? A world in which everybody has an equal break, and we should be way beyond that. So we've got a lot of work to do, and we'll require a lot of independent thought. And that's, I guess, all that I've been wanting to say. Thank you.
And that does it for today's show. That was Howard Zinn from 1988, speaking in Janesville. A special thank you to our engineer, Jay Davis, and the work of WORT's archiving team. You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. Up next is Letters and Politics.
Situation.
According to our colleagues in the Office of Humanitarian Affairs, they tell us that we